dodges. I ride in this wind on my good horse. I call you my shiny black bears to the playhouse of fortune to take the bright silver and gold you have taken from somebody else. And as we go riding in the damp foggy night, you snort my good pony and you give me your best. For you know and I know, good horse amongst the rich ones, how oft times we go there, an unwelcome guest.
You're tuned to WEOS Geneva, WXXE Finner Syracuse, or WXXE Truxton. This is Unwelcome Guests. I'm Lynn Gary. Is the war on terrorism a response to the September 11th attacks, or is it part of a larger and long-planned attempt to gain and keep control of Central Asia and its wealth in order to shore up a U.S. economy teetering on the brink of collapse? What do drugs and oil have to do with it? Mike Rupert has been publicly critical of the official story presented by the government in the wake of the 9/11 attacks. Rupert is a former narcotics detective from the Los Angeles Police Department who was forced out in 1978 after he attempted to expose what he'd learned of the Central Intelligence Agency's role in drug trafficking. He's the publisher of the From the Wilderness newsletter, which focuses on reporting on the role of drug money in the U.S. economy and covert government operations that maintain control of that cash flow on behalf of U.S. economic interests. Tonight we're going to hear most of the soundtrack of Truth and Lies of 9/11, a more than two-hour video based on a lecture Rupert gave at Portland State University last November. Rupert has offered a reward of $1,000 to anyone who can impeach the authenticity of his sources. He presents a series of facts to support the theories he advances. You decide to what extent he's made his case.
I treat horses good, and I'm friendly to strangers.
Thank you, Demetrius, and thank all of you. I am unbelievably gratified to see so many people here tonight. I almost got up here and said, hi, my name is Mike, I'm an alcoholic, but I think I'm at the wrong meeting, I guess. We're going to talk about a lot of things tonight that are very difficult, a lot of things tonight that are very challenging, a lot of things that will test and try many of us in the months and the years to come. But we're going to have a certain approach to this, and it's the only kind of approach that I have found in 23 years that works when you're challenging a government that no longer serves the interests of the people. I'd like to start off by asking a question, like a show of hands. How many people in the room tonight believe that Lee Harvey Oswald was the lone gunman and solely responsible for the murder of John F. Kennedy? Show of hands. Two hands and they're both joking. How many people in the room tonight believe that the war that is now taking place and getting ready to move all over the world is solely the result of the attacks on the World Trade Center on September the 11th? Okay, all right, great. The approach that we're going to take tonight is very straightforward. I was, for some short period of time, not as much as I wanted to be, an investigator with LAPD. I worked narcotics, I was loaned to detectives, I worked a homicide table, I worked a burglary table and an auto theft table for a while. And there is a procedure that you follow when you are presenting evidence. There is a way that you structure evidence to avoid speculation, and there is a way to fight this government. And before we start into the details on September the 11th, I want to show you two dramatic examples. I have two short clips of video that I would like to show you. And if we can run the first one, this will set the tone for what we're going to talk about tonight and what we're not going to talk about tonight. For 38 years, as of November 22nd, just a few days ago, we have had a videotape showing clearly that John F. Kennedy was shot from the front and not the back, where the Warren Commission says that Lee Harvey Oswald was up and behind to the right in the Texas School Book Depository. You look at this tape, and there is clear, convincing, incontrovertible evidence. Yet what good has it done us? What has it done to change the government? What has it done? What have we, meaning the American people, accomplished with this piece of video that shows his head moving backwards as a result of a bullet impact from the front of his head? It hasn't changed anything. I want you to bear that in mind, because I'm going to use the word you a lot tonight. And by you, I mean the American people. I'm talking to you as if I was talking to all 280 million people in this country. And I'm going to say some things that are going to be kind of backing you into a corner. And that is my direct intent. So some of the things we are not going to talk about tonight are speculations about the attacks on September the 11th. We are not going to talk about, were there explosives in the building, were the planes piloted by remote control, any of those questions, because those are speculative questions that produce the same kind of results that we just saw on the tape. After 38 years, you can play that all you want and it doesn't change anything. There are people who have been talking about the Oklahoma City bombing since it happened in 1995. We have videotape of US military personnel machine gunning the Branch Davidians at Waco. We have proof up the galore. We're not here looking tonight for proof. We're not going to go home and have armchair discussions, because what's at stake now is our freedom. What's at stake now is our future. This is no more time to go home, and you'll see that before I'm through tonight. Now, there is another way to take on the government. There is another way to take on the lunacy of the mass media, and that is by using their own statements and their own evidence against them to prove that they are lying. Because if you're in this room tonight, you are probably already the choir. Our safety, our future, our liberty, our country, and maybe the planet depends upon us reaching out to the millions of people out there who are still waving the flag, still believing that this is a war like they're being sold on CNN. Now, I'm going to play another tape now, and I'm going to show you what happens when you confront the government with their own information head on. This is a confrontation I had with the director of Central Intelligence, John Deutsch, at Locke High School in 1996 over the issue of the CIA bringing drugs into Los Angeles. I want you to watch his hands very carefully after I confront him.
Sir, the man in the leather
jacket. Congresswoman Juanita Millender McDonald of Compton.
I will be coming back.
Hi.
Over. I'll get you.
I am a former Los Angeles police narcotics detective, and I work South Central Los Angeles, and I will tell you, Director Deutsch, emphatically and
can
without equivocation.
Can you speak further into the mic, sir? These mics don't seem to be...
I will tell you, Director Deutsch, as a former Los Angeles police narcotics detective, that the agency has dealt drugs throughout this country for a long time. Director Deutsch, I will refer you to three specific agency operations known as Amadeus, Pegasus, and Watchtower. I have Watchtower documents heavily redacted by the agency. I was personally exposed to CIA operations and recruited by CIA personnel who attempted to recruit me in the late 70s. to become involved in protecting agency drug operations in this country. I have been trying to get this out for 18 years, and I have the evidence. My question for you is very specific, sir. If in the course of the IG's investigations and Fred Hitz's work, you come across evidence of severely criminal activity,
let him speak into
and it's
the mic.
Classified, will you use that classification to hide the criminal activity, or will you tell the American people the truth?
Watch his hands. Watch his hands.
All right, you want to hear the response first from Congressman Julian Dixon and then from the director. Wait. Wait a minute. From York. I'm sorry, sir. I will allow the director to speak first and then Congressman Julian Dixon.
If you have information about CIA illegal activity in drugs, you should immediately bring that information to wherever you want, but let me suggest three places. The Los Angeles Police Department.
Gotcha.
I'm sorry, others want to hear this answer. I am sorry. Others want to hear this answer.
It is your choice, the Los Angeles Police Department, the Inspector General, or office of one of your Congress persons from this.
I did that 18 years ago, sir, and I got shot at for it.
Wait a minute, sir.
And?
Sir, you have not gotten the mic yet. You are not. But wait a minute, then. Don't speak out of turn.
Let me say something else. If this information turns up wrongdoing, we will bring the people to justice and make them accountable.
Keep the noise down so that we can hear and we can get answers.
For the record, my name is Mike Rupert, R-U-P-P-E-R-T. I did bring this information out 18 years ago, and I got shot at and forced out of LAPD because of it. I've been on the record for 18 years nonstop, and I'll be happy to give you, Congressman, anything that I have.
I have to tell you that that was probably the most fun I've ever had in my life. What happened after this was John Deutsch was guaranteed an appointment by Bill Clinton to become the next Secretary of Defense. My confrontation with John Deutsch cost him that appointment. So let's take an approach to September the 11th along the lines of an investigator presenting a case to a grand jury. First of all, who am I? We're going to go through this really quickly. I had the misfortune of being born into a family that was heavily rooted in the intelligence community. My mother was a cryptographer and cryptanalyst for the Army Security Agency and National Security Agency during World War II. She worked for Secretary of State Cordell Hull. She worked on the Japanese and Russian codes. By the way, we did know the Japs were going to attack Pearl Harbor, and we did let it happen. This is evidence that I would present. This is my mother's separation from the NSA in December 1949 because she was going to have babies. She didn't have me until 51. But my dad was also recalled into the Air Force during the Korean War. He went to work for Martin Marietta and went to work on projects like the Titan IIIC, which put up all the CIA's keyhole spy satellites. Relatives of my father were OSS, that's the forerunner of CIA, and they were career at CIA in Langley. So everybody in the family had a clearance. Continuing with the presentation, there's a couple of points I want to make here in Portland. This is one of my rating reports from LAPD showing an outstanding rating, showing also that I have, especially in the field of narcotics enforcement and investigative procedures, I was loaned to Wilshire Division Narcotics several times and specialized in narcotics. I was even sent to a training school by the U.S. Department of Justice and the DEA, which I attended. You don't get that for writing parking tickets. And the reason why I say this is because the ranking member of LAPD in the room that day when I confronted John Deutsch told Ted Koppel that I had never worked narcotics. And that got me pulled from a live interview with Ted Koppel. The ranking member of LAPD in the room that day was Deputy Chief Mark Croker. Now I want to talk about CIA dealing drugs briefly because I have to lay a foundation. You have to understand the economic and the political context in which this war is taking place and in which it is set. And there's two things that if you don't understand, you will never understand September the 11th. One is drugs, the other is oil. We want to talk about evidence. We want to talk about proof, okay? This is a memorandum that was written February 11th, 1982, to the Honorable William J. Casey. Everybody remember Bill Casey from Iran-Contra? CIA director, signed by Attorney General William French Smith. This was at the beginning of the Contra War, very early in the Reagan administration. And something had happened before this. There had been a series of negotiations. Now, in the CIA, the highest rung on the food chain is called an officer. If you are a case officer at CIA, you are someone who cannot be disavowed or denied. You are a man of the cloth. You are a man blessed with immunity. The agency will protect you. But underneath that on the food chain, they have career agents, contract agents, foreign agents, informants. They have proprietary companies, employees of the proprietary. There's a whole category of people. Well, in 1982, because the CIA knew there was going to be a massive explosion in cocaine trafficking that they were going to control, U.S. Cocaine consumption went from roughly 80 metric tons in 1979 to 600 metric tons by 1987. Think about that for a minute. That's a lot of coke. All right. They knew that was coming. All right. So one of the things they did legally, because the agency and the government, they always find paper ways to try to cover their trail, and they think nobody will catch them. One of my favorite lines of all time, and for the first 100 of you who got here, you got a free copy of my last issue of From the Wilderness, is from Alan Dulles, who, when the Warren Commission report was released, all however many volumes there were, and you read those volumes and you know that Lee Harvey Oswald didn't kill John Kennedy. And Alan Dulles said, the American people don't read. You don't read. This memorandum says, first of all, they took all the people who were not case officers and they decided to call them non-employees of the Central Intelligence Agency. There's a federal law stating that if a federal employee breaks a federal law, you have to report him. They were caught on the horns of a dilemma. So first they said, well, all these people are not employees, even though they get CIA paychecks. And then they said, in light of these provisions and in view of the fine cooperation the Drug Enforcement Administration has received from CIA, no formal requirement regarding the reporting of narcotics violations has been included in these procedures. That's black and white evidence of a conspiracy. The Attorney General of the United States just told the CIA director he no longer had to report it when anybody other than a case officer was dealing drugs. Let's look at something else about how cynical these people are. Now, I've been studying CIA and the drug trade for about 23 years, and this is one of my favorite documents of all time. Some 28 C-130 Hercules were smuggled by the CIA and the Pentagon through the U.S. Forest Service into private hands, supposedly for the purpose of fighting forest fires. The problem was is that some of them turned up in Peru, in Mexico, in Panama, in Angola, in Iran, and Iraq, running covert missions for the CIA. One of these C-130s was caught in Mexico City, Aeropostal de Mexico had it, with $1 billion worth of cocaine on board. The Forest Service, having let these airplanes out, found itself in a kind of embarrassing position. So they had their lawyers work on it, and notice the last sentence. DOD is the Department of Defense. Apparently, DOD thinks that by having the Forest Service as the intermediary, if any future aircraft are used in drug smuggling, the Forest Service and not DOD will suffer the adverse publicity. They don't care about stopping it, they care about who's going to take the blame. It is possible to nail these people. but you have to know how to approach. The main reason why the CIA deals drugs is for one reason and one reason only. It's not to fund covert operations. The main reason is not to weed out the gene pool, although I will tell you, and I have proven, that blacks have been deliberately targeted, but the CIA brings in more drugs than all the African Americans could use in this country. The main reason the CIA deals drugs is to support the US economy. Let's take a look for a second. I don't know if you can read this in the back, but I'll call the names out. We're going to see something that's very unusual here. The National Security Act of 1947 created the CIA. It was written by a man named Clark Clifford, who was a longtime aide to Harry Truman. Okay? Clark Clifford's profession was he was a Wall Street banker and lawyer. Clark Clifford is also the man who brought a bank called BCCI into the United States in the 1980s, a drug money laundering bank that was exposed for laundering drug money. The design for the CIA, in other words, the people who told Clifford how to write the act, were two brothers, John Foster and Alan Dulles, the Dulles brothers, Dull, Duller, and Dullest. John Foster Dulles was Secretary of State to President Dwight Eisenhower. Alan Dulles was the DCI, not from 81 to 87, he was the DCI from, I think, roughly 1953 until about 61 in the Bay of Pigs when John F. Kennedy fired him. You know what their profession was? Wall Street lawyers at the law firm of Sullivan and Cromwell, which is today the most powerful law firm on Wall Street. Bill Casey, the man we just saw the memo addressed to, we know he was Ronald Reagan's DCI. What did Bill Casey do for Richard Nixon? He was chairman of the Securities and Exchange Commission. Stanley Sporkin, one of my favorite turkeys, was CIA general counsel during the 80s. He used to email back and forth with Oliver North. Dear Stanley to Ollie, Stanley to Ollie. It was very funny. Okay? Do you know what he did before he became? No, he was the general counsel to the SEC, Securities and Exchange Commission, charged with monitoring all securities transactions. David Daugherty, CIA general counsel after Stanley Sporkin. You know what he does today? The executive vice president of the New York Stock Exchange for enforcement. Isn't that great? And then we have a gentleman by the name of A.B. Buzzy Krongard, and we're going to hear a lot about Buzzy Krongard tonight. Buzzy Krongard is currently the CIA executive director. The top three positions are DCI, Director of Central Intelligence, DDI, Deputy Director of Intelligence, and Executive Director. Buzzy Krongard was, until 1998, the head of an investment bank called A.B. Brown. A.B. Brown is involved in insider trading connected to September the 11th. He's a Wall Street banker. As a matter of fact, 6 out of 7 of the first deputy directors of intelligence came to CIA from Wall Street. The mission of the CIA is to control money and cash flow for the benefit not of you and me, but for the benefit of the banks and the stock brokerage houses and all of the interests that control US politics. Now, the US economy is in deep trouble. But the level of criminality in this government and in this country has become so overt in the last 2 years that the stink is becoming hard for people to ignore. This is a story from the Associated Press, June 27th, 1999. New York Stock Exchange chief, that's a guy by the name of Dick Grasso, hops on an airplane in New York City and flies to Bogota, Colombia, hops in an armor-plated limousine and drives up to the foothills in the mountains that are occupied by the FARC guerrillas, who occupy a third of Colombia. They tax the cocaine. Everybody in Colombia deals drugs. But what did he ask them to do? He asked the FARC guerrillas to invest their drug profits in Wall Street. There's an AP story right there. He didn't say, stop dealing drugs, it's bad for our kids. He said, let us manage your drug money. The FARC said, we think we would rather keep our money in Colombia for the benefit of Colombians. Why should we send it to New York? And what happened a year later was Bill Clinton announced Plan Colombia. And don't get me wrong here, Colombia is on the list of countries where this administration is planning to go to war because there's also oil there. All right. Still laying a foundation, but we're getting ready to move into September 11th. Let's look at a little history of the Bush family. I'm having a lot of fun. Okay. This is from a book called The Unauthorized Biography of George Bush, which is an extremely well-researched book. And everything that they put in here is sourced. If we go to George Herbert Walker Bush's father, Prescott Bush, he was the managing director of a firm called Brown Brothers Harriman during the 30s and 40s. Brown Brothers Harriman financed Adolf Hitler before and during World War II. Brown Brothers Harriman got involved with the Hamburg Steamship Line. They got involved with a number of companies and front organizations that channeled money directly to Adolf Hitler, and they did not stop that relationship when the war began. As a matter of fact, one particular firm, it was a bank affiliated, it was the Union Bank, affiliated with the Thyssen, that's Thyssen Steel Trust, managed by Prescott Bush, produced 50.8% of Nazi Germany's pig iron, 41.4% of Nazi Germany's universal plate, 36% of Nazi Germany's heavy plate, 38.5% of Nazi Germany's galvanized steel, 45.5% of Nazi Germany's pipes and tubes, 22% of Nazi Germany's wire, and 35% of Nazi Germany's explosives. It was so egregious and offensive that we find that in 1942, under the Trading with the Enemy Act, the US government took over the Union Banking Corporation, in which Prescott Bush was a director, and they seized the assets. That's our current president's grandfather. Now, we know that our current president's father went out of his way to arm Saddam Hussein. How many people remember Iraqgate? I have an excellent story on that. There's monstrous, wonderful sourcing on the fact that George Herbert Walker Bush created the enemy which he fought in 1991. And so it is currently with Osama bin Laden. Now, how important is drug money? The International Monetary Fund published a report in January of this year showing that $1.5 trillion, trillion with a T, a year is laundered through the world banking system. Of that, according to Le Monde and according to the US Department of Justice, it's very safe to say that $500 billion to $600 billion of that is directly the result of the drug trade. Why is drug cash important? The United States economy has derivatives. Derivatives are anything that's not related to anything of value. It's like stock futures, it's calls, it's puts, it's options. It has a derivatives bubble of $300 trillion. $20 trillion of that alone is connected to JP Morgan Chase, which is about ready to go under thanks to Enron. Just in March of this year, we had a wonderful piece of evidence come up from Senator Carl Levin's minority report to the Senate Permanent Subcommittee on Investigations, and it was a report on correspondent banks and money laundering. Now, this is a story from the Washington Post dated February 5th. It says, inattention and disinterest by U.S. banks in screening the foreign banks they take as clients has allowed rogue foreign banks, not rogue, and their criminal clients to carry on money laundering and other criminal activity in the United States and to benefit from the protections afforded by the safety and the soundness of the U.S. banking industry, said Senator Carl Levin of Michigan. Specifically mentions J.P. Morgan Chase on the next page. 4,000 offshore banks to launder money into the United States. $1 trillion laundered annually. That's conservative. Money laundered in which the Clinton administration declared a national security threat. Not true. It's a national asset as far as Wall Street is concerned. Carl Levin said $500 billion moved through the U.S. banking system in drug money every year. That's liquid cash. And you want to know how important liquid cash in this world? There's a saying. One of my dear friends and colleagues and mentor, Catherine Austin Fitz, is a former assistant secretary of housing. She was a managing director of Dillon Reed on Wall Street. She says, cash flow is everything. And in an economy that's on the verge of a major implosion, without cash flow, the crash is guaranteed. Now, CIA's role is to make sure that as much of that drug money comes through the U.S. economy as possible. Okay? This is a copy of the cover sheet of the report. It's on the World Wide Web. If you want to go search for it, you can just look for the report on correspondent banking. Okay? And that's a copy of the report. It's an incredible read. What they don't tell you in there, of course, is that the U.S. economy is dependent upon that drug money, among other things. Now let's go a little further. Gotta love this. If this gentleman down here in the black jacket walks into a bank with a deposit of $10,001, does everybody understand that the bank has to fill out a report and send it to the U.S. Treasury indicating that he might be a money launderer? But did you happen to know that under U.S. laws, there are certain classes of business that are exempt from making currency transaction reports? Included in those are a bank, obviously, a department or agency of the U.S. government. CIA does not have to fill out currency transaction reports. An entity established under the laws of any state, yeah, yeah, yeah. But you come down to this one. A listed entity other than a bank whose common or analogous equity interests are listed on the New York Stock Exchange or American Stock Exchange or designated as a NASDAQ national market security. If you have a company that trades on Wall Street, you can launder all the money you want to. It's legal. Gee. Now I'm just laying a little groundwork here for you before we get to September 11th. We're getting there. Just last year, a group of companies were called in to meet with Janet Reno, who's not probably the most ethical person that ever lived, and Secretary of State Stewart, Deputy Treasury Secretary Stuart Eisenstadt. And these companies, Hewlett-Packard, Ford, Sony, General Motors, Whirlpool, General Electric, and Philip Morris were called in to the Department of Justice for the amount of drug money they were laundering. Basically, the message was, you guys, cool it. Okay? It's getting, like, out of hand. Now, let me ask a question. This gentleman right here, what's your name?
Kevin.
Kevin is a drug lord. Kevin is the king of all drugs in South America. Okay? All right, and let's say this young lady right down here with the glasses, what's your name?
Rhonda.
Rhonda is the executive vice president of General Motors for the Southern Hemisphere, or South America, okay? Kevin, you call up Rhonda one day, and you say, I'd like 100 Chevy Suburbans, armor-plated, custom-built, at $30,000 each, and I'll pay cash. Rhonda, what are you going to say to that offer?
All right.
Now, Kevin's got money that he can't spend because it's drug money. But now he's got 100 Chevy Suburbans. But let's say now that, the gentleman with his hand on his chin right there. Yeah, right there. What's your name? No, you. What's your name?
Brian.
Brian is Jack Welch, the chairman of General Electric. Okay? Now, Kevin, you're really good. Okay? You got $200 million that you got to move. Okay? So you call up Jack Welch's assistant, special accounts assistant. You say, I'd like to open in South America Kevin's Appliances. I'd like to buy $200 million of everything GE has, because I'm going to open this appliance store and I'll pay you cash. Now, Jack Welch at GE, what do you say? Right on. Let's do this deal. Now, by the way, who owns NBC? General Electric. MSNBC, CNBC, all the NBCs. Okay. Now, let's just take a look at that for one quick second. Very quickly, a price-to-earnings ratio, P to E, market capitalization. It's very simple. If you have a company that has 10,000 shares, and each share sells for $10. Did I say 1,000 shares? 1,000 shares, $10. Your market capitalization is $10,000. You multiply the share price by the number of shares. Market capitalization. You divide that by net profits. In other words, what you sell less the cost of doing business. And you come up with a ratio. This is how they value the stock market. Okay, so if you have a company that has a $300 million market capitalization and a $10 million net profit, the price to earnings is 30. The POP is 30. And that's about right. And by the way, the current Dow Jones Industrial Average is overpriced by about two-thirds. Okay? Now, if you have this 30-to-1 ratio, if I add another $1 million, my pen went dry. If I add another $1 million and make that 2, what happens to this number? Becomes 60. All right? Now, the lady in red down here, who's looking away from me. Ma'am, what's your name?
Karen.
Karen owns an orange juice company. Makes the best orange juice in the world. And I owe all of what I'm teaching you now to Catherine Austin Fitz. And she's just she has a wonderful website at solari.com. And we'll put those up before I leave. You make incredible orange juice. Okay, the best orange juice in the world, it's fairly priced. Karen's orange juice, right? Okay. You have $1 million net profit a year. Now, let's say this young lady down here in the glasses with the light green sweater. What's your name? That's you. What's your name?
Chris.
Chris is the chief executive officer of PepsiCo, which owns a small orange juice company called Tropicana. Okay. You see her company with $1 million in net profit. How much, and your price to earnings is 30-to-1, how much are you willing to pay for that? How much are you willing to pay for her company? Would you pay $29 million?
Yeah,
because the minute you bought her company for $29 million, your stock value goes up $30 million. How do Wall Street executives get paid? In stock. And you watch very closely the Bush administration's plan for economic recovery. It's all handouts to the corporation, which will go directly to boost their POP, which will put hundreds of millions of dollars in the pockets of executives. Has anybody noticed the Bush administration has not offered one single aid plan for any unemployed airline worker? All right, let's get down and dirty here. Oh, one more thing. Remember that guy, John Deutsch, that I had fun with? Okay, well, right now he's on the board of directors of Citibank. Along with the former executive director of the CIA, who is not on the board, but she's a very highly placed executive, Nora Slatkin. John Deutsch, of course, is as crooked as the rest of them. Also on the board of Citibank is a guy named Robert Rubin, former U.S. Secretary of the Treasury. Yes, thank you. He deserves all the hisses he can get. Well, in May of this year, Citibank announced a $12 billion cash purchase of a Mexican bank called Banamex, second largest bank in Mexico, also a documented, and I mean documented, drug money laundering bank that was exposed in a Mexican newspaper. Roberto Hernandez, this is him, gets a seat on Citibank's board of directors, and yet this is what's going on his property. He owns thousands of acres near Cancun in Mexico. The locals call it the Cocaine Peninsula. There's hundreds of photographs. He lost two lawsuits in Mexico. And then my friend Al Giordano, who publishes a great website called www.narconews.com, wrote a great story about the Mexican paper stories, and Hernandez sued Giordano in New York, and he's going to lose that lawsuit, by the way. Al Giordano's a brave journalist. But the point I'm making with this is that the criminality had gotten so out of hand by May of this year that Citibank would openly buy a known drug money laundering bank and put the drug money launderer on its board of directors. That's the need for drug cash in the U.S. economy right now. By the way, Citibank's record of involvement in drug money laundering is extremely well documented in the Wall Street Journal and the New York Times. It laundered some, I think, $300 or $400 million for Raul Salinas de Gortari, the brother of the former Mexican president. Now let's go to some other things that are going on in the economy so that we set you up to understand what's going on around September the 11th. The U.S. economy is being looted. Anybody here remember the savings and loan scandal? You know, the gang that's in the White House is the same gang that brought us the savings and loan scandal? That took $500 billion out of your pockets. Well, here's some new developments in the government. And by the way, I'm not a Democrat or a Republican. Bill Clinton's a sleazebag too. Okay? That so-called liberal put almost a million nonviolent drug offenders in prison to boost the shares of companies like Corrections Corporation of America and Wackenhut. He destroyed many of the welfare laws, and you know, one is not better than the other. But notice this, HUD loses, HUD, Housing and Urban Development, $59 billion. When was the last time you lost $59 billion? This was from testimony in Congress by Susan Gaffney, Inspector General of HUD. And you know what HUD said they did when they couldn't figure out where the money went? We made an adjustment in our checkbook. Where's that money going? You'll find out before we're through. Now, if you thought that was bad, the Defense Department cannot account for $1.1 trillion that seems to have vanished within the tangled system of financial accounting put in place by private contractors. You know who the private contractors are? Lockheed Martin and DynCorp. Okay? HUD, this is from a very great reporter, a very courageous woman who had served on the Capitol Hill for many years and became an investigative reporter named Kelly O'Meara, who writes for the Washington Times Insight magazine. I know it's owned by the Moon, but Kelly does fabulous work, and she's written a great piece on civil rights after the September 11th attack. The point is that $4.4 trillion in adjustments to the Pentagon books had to be cooked to compile the required financial statements, and that $1.1 trillion of that amount could not be supported by any reliable information. All right, now, there's one thing I got to do before we get to September the 11th and what's happening since. It's easy to say that this is a war about oil, and you're going to know more about it than you did when you came in here. When you leave, the entire world economy is on the brink of a major collapse. And in the 3 weeks prior to the attacks, the Dow had dropped almost 900 points. Now, what we have seen since then, and you must understand this clearly, is that the Dow's so-called resurrection to close to 10,000 points is strictly the result of a massive infusion of cash from the US Treasury, which is your cash, which is being given to the corporate executives and not to the people who have been laid off. And every time you see the Dow go up, you'd better believe that another 5,000-10,000 people have lost their jobs. But it is not sustainable for a number of reasons. And then this brings us into the issue of oil briefly, and we'll get into this more later. And basically is that oil production in the world is peaking. The last untapped major oil fields in the world are in two places, actually. First, Central Asia, and we'll get into that in depth. And second, guess where? In Colombia. Okay? And this is now a war, and this is now a moment in human history when the age of oil is nearing its end, because world population and demand world population and demand will exceed production sometime within roughly the next 10 years. And we're going to get into that for why. But now let's go back into the warnings about September the 11th. And I didn't do a lot of this, and we have time. Osama bin Laden is, of course, a Saudi Arabian by birth. His family is exceptionally wealthy. They own not only major construction companies, but they are heavy investors in high technology stocks like Nortel. They have a piece of Pepsi, I think, and Coca-Cola. They're into everything. They're very wealthy. In 1976, Osama's older brother, Salim bin Laden, hired a man in Texas by the name of Jim Bath, who has CIA connections, to handle all the investments in the United States for the bin Laden family. Jim Bath also happens to be a personal, almost lifelong friend and former Air National Guard pilot with George W. Bush. And immediately after Jim Bath made the arrangements to took over the bin Laden family's finances, Jim Bath made a $50,000 investment in George W. Bush's first company, Arbusto Energy. The connections between the Bushes and the bin Ladens become much more clear as you move forward, and we have reported this in From the Wilderness. Again, I was using stories, and you'll see this. When George Herbert Walker Bush made trips to Saudi Arabia in 1998 and 2000 to meet with the Saudi royal family and to meet with the bin Laden family, which he finally acknowledged, along with former British Prime Minister John Major, on behalf of a company called the Carlyle Group, which is the 11th largest defense contractor in the country. Carlyle Group is a privately owned corporation. That means they do not have to report their ownership or financial activities to the SEC. Yet they provide all kinds of the highest technology equipment to the US Pentagon. And Carlyle, of course, has made several, probably $1 billion, and will as a result of this war. In that context, Osama bin Laden went to Afghanistan in 1979, 1980, maybe the early 80s, to fight the Russians. And he was supported by the CIA. And it's interesting to note that when the Russians invaded Afghanistan, 0%, and this is from Professor Alfred McCoy of the University of Wisconsin, who's also one of my subscribers, in a great book called The Politics of Heroin, 0% of the US consumption of heroin came from Pakistan, Afghanistan before the Russian invasion. By 1985, 86, 40% of the heroin in the United States came from that region, all controlled by the Central Intelligence Agency. And Osama bin Laden came up under a guy named Gulbadin Hekmatyar, who ran 6 heroin labs, all protected by the CIA and controlled by the agency. He has been a CIA asset for a long period of time. We'll see more about that. He is a CIA creation. Now we come to September 11th, and we're going to go into a timeline here. And I have written several stories, and I was on the radio here with Sheila Hamilton at KPAM just a few days after the attacks. And I was saying the US government knew these attacks were going to take place and did not stop them. And I keep building to that evidence. But I'm going to show you a couple of things now. Not by any means all of the evidence that I have of foreknowledge, but just a couple of telling points. Israeli security issued urgent warning to CIA of large-scale terror attacks. And this is a long story saying that the Israeli Mossad knew that the attacks were going to take place. They knew that the World Trade Center were the targets. This is from the British paper, The Telegraph. Two senior experts with Mossad were sent to Washington in August to alert the CIA, and so on and so forth. This is just one of probably 24 examples that I have that are absolutely specific. Now, bear in mind that if what I'm showing you is known overtly through the media, how much more does our $30 billion intelligence community know? There's a recurring theme out there that maybe the Israelis did this. You hear that in some right-wing circles. Horsepucky. They didn't do it. They were warning the U.S. hand over fist, and the U.S. did not listen because it needed the attacks. And you will be convinced of that. But here's one of the most telling pieces of evidence that I found. We reviewed the list of former tenants of the World Trade Center at the online Wall Street Journal site, and there's the website. It is an alphabetical list of tenants. Scroll to the very bottom and notice the moving date for the office of Zim American Israeli Shipping to Norfolk, Virginia. They were in the World Trade Center. They must have had Mossad's input because they vacated 1 week before September the 11th, and they broke their lease. The Israelis didn't pull the attack, but they were smart enough to get their people out of the way. How come our government didn't do the same thing for us? Now we're getting into the heart of September the 11th. I picked up this document just a few days after the attacks, September 23rd. And it's from the Herzliya Institute for Counterterrorism. It is an Israeli counterterrorist think tank. Of course, it's connected with the Mossad. And what they detailed, this is from the October 15th issue of From the Wilderness. Between September 6th and 7th, the Chicago Board of Options Exchange saw purchases of 4,744 put options on United Airlines and only 396 call options. A put option is basically a bet that the stock price is going to go down. It's a contract that's entered into that's irrevocable. And let's say the gentleman in the suspenders, I do a put option deal with you to sell shares at $100 in 2 weeks, 4 months. 4 months is the standard, but you can write the contract for anything you want. And he's committed now to buy the shares for $100. Well, if I know that the attacks are going to take place, I don't have to deliver the shares until the contract matures. So if I know the stock is going to crash, he enters into a put agreement with me, agrees to buy the shares at $100. The next day the World Trade Center attacks happen, the stocks are selling for $20. I go buy the shares for $20, and he has to buy them for $100. That's how a put option works. That's a short version, okay? So we saw 4,744 put options on United Airlines, but only 396 call options. On September the 10th, 4,516 put options, same deal, were placed on American Airlines, bought on the Chicago Exchange, compared to only 748 calls. There were no other similar trades on any other airlines. And this level of put options was like 600 to 1,200% above normal for United and American Airlines. Now, just these trades alone, there were also put options placed on Merrill Lynch, which had 22 floors. Morgan Stanley had 22 floors, and Merrill Lynch had an offices near. Both were heavily impacted. Heavy put options there, heavy put options on reinsurance companies, Munich Reinsurance, the largest in the world, AXA Reinsurance in France, which owned 25% of American. Totally out of whack, absolutely spiking. There's another newsletter that says very clearly, by a guy by the name of Phil Erlanger, and this is his newsletter, that the insider trading may have cost $1 billion. Now these ones that were identified, produced only $2.5 million in instant profits for somebody who knew the attacks were going to take place. Nobody claimed the profits. The San Francisco Chronicle caught it shortly thereafter, and nobody has claimed them since. And we don't know who made the trades. But what did the Herzliya Institute for Counterterrorism tell us? It told us that the United Airlines put options were placed through the firm A.B. Brown. Do you remember A.B. Brown? A.B. Brown was the firm headed until 1998 by A.B. Buzzy Krongard, who is now the executive director of the Central Intelligence Agency. A.B. Brown was sold in 97 to Bankers Trust, then to Deutsche Bank, I think in 98 or 99. It was an offshoot of Deutsche Bank. Now, one thing that I know, that I have written heavily about, is that the CIA, the Mossad, and major intelligence services track all stock trading in real time. On my website, you'll see stories about Promise Software, and it's very long to go into, but it's a very sophisticated software and is capable of integrating wide numbers of databases in different languages. You'll find this on my website,
at www.copvcia.com.
Now, I know that CIA and Mossad track stock trades in real time, so if all these put options were placed on American and United, do you think that should have triggered some alarm inside the Central Intelligence Agency? But instead, we find that the trades were placed through a firm that was once owned, managed, by the guy who was the number three at CIA. This is just pieces of evidence now. I'm building the case. Now, again, we're building up some history here. In January of this year, the Taliban and Al-Qaeda destroyed the entire opium crop in Afghanistan. It's been verified by the United Nations, by the Drug Enforcement Administration, by ABC News, by BBC, who put people on the ground. Afghanistan had been the world's largest producer of opium, producing 70% of the world's heroin through the year 2000. In January, they destroyed their crop. Part of it was a price support. They had overproduced the year before, part of it, and they sold from their stockpiles. But there are no opium crops in Afghanistan right now. They've all been planted, of course, since the Bush administration and the CIA have lifted the ban and everybody can go back to work and the CIA can move the heroin again.
You're listening to Mike Rubert's presentation of The Truth and Lies of 9/11 on WEOS Geneva, WXXE Fenner Syracuse, or WXXC Truxton. This is Unwelcome Guests.